Okay, welcome back. Hope you had a good weekend as we step into another week, the first full week in February. Up first tonight is Ralph Schoenemann. Ralph is a scholar's scholar, a researcher's researcher when it comes to the Middle East. And I mean, this man is brilliant. I remember years ago when I was in college, someone played a tape for me and he said, sit down and listen to this. You think you know the Middle East, listen to this. And it was Ralph Schoenemann delivering a lecture in Santa Barbara. And I was amazed. And I kid you not, Ralph was the man who showed me way back then that the world was vastly different than the controlled oil-soaked monopoly press, as Sherman Skolnick always called it, would have us believe, or our textbooks, our educational systems. And remember, the winners write the history, and the losers lose. And I wanted to have Ralph on the program some weeks ago, finally got him. He's here tonight. We're going to talk about the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Israel. There is a tremendous amount of dynamics involved here that that could lead to any number of very serious and catastrophic consequences for a lot of people. So let's say hello to our good friend and colleague, Ralph Schoenemann. Hi, Ralph.
Hello, Jeff. Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you and to share time with that mind of yours, which knows no equal in my humble estimation. I mean
that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. All right, well, the war drums are being beaten by the Zionist warmongers, neocons, whatever you want to call them. And of course, this is war for profit. It is war for genocidal reasons. It is war for geopolitical reasons. And is it going to be a war? Let's start with that. What's your take on the latest with the Iran situation and the big military buildup ongoing?
I think all parts and sections of the U.S. ruling class is committed to expanded war, not only in the Middle East, but beyond. The debate and the dispute has to do with how this is to be conducted. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with what is called the political bombshell from Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Shocking. I was amazed, yeah.
You know, it is in its own way quite remarkable that a person with the credentials and role of Brzezinski should give the kind of testimony that he did before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And it is, I think, a measure of the bitter and anxious split that's unfolding within sectors of the rulers about this prospective all-out attack on Iran and the broadening of the war.
Now, this is a country, Ralph, excuse me, for our listeners, in case you folks don't know this, this is a country of either 70 or 80 million people. I don't remember the number.
Yes,
this is not another
correct.
Iraq. Yeah.
No, it's many times the size of Iraq, and as you say, the population... I think it's officially at 70 million, but the population is undoubtedly somewhat larger than that. I think we have to keep in mind, Jeff, that the Iran as Iraq had been within the gun sights of the United States policymakers and, of course, of the Israeli state in particular, for many, many decades. And there is an entire imperial history with specific regard to Iran. The British had colonized Iran, and they had retained a syphilitic corporal who was the first made the first Shah by British colonialism. And the main task of that corporal was to wage ethnic war on the various nationalities that comprise Iran. Iran is a multi-ethnic state, as are
right.
most, not only in the Middle East, after all, composed of perhaps 48% Persian or Farsi-speaking peoples, and then there are the Azerbaijani Turks, which are a very large minority in Iran. There's the Arab minority of the oil-producing province of Khuzestan, also known as Arabistan. There are the Baluchi and the Turkmeni, and there are various nationalities. But Iran has a thousands-of-year history as a national entity, and its various ethnic and religious groupings saw themselves as Iranian. Whatever their particular local affiliation or linguistic affiliation may be. Notwithstanding that, I want to point jump ahead to say that at the time of 1952, mm-hmm. when the national movement in Iran, which is like the national movements all over the Middle East, were seeking that independence from colonial domination and from the control of their natural resources, primarily oil, the national movement of Mossadegh gained a vast majority, and Mossadegh was the premier, and he nationalized oil. So the British intelligence services enlisted the Central Intelligence Agency.
A fatal mistake, as they say. Yeah, exactly. Now you just
and that goes back to 1953, and Iran has been within the target sites of U.S. imperialism ever since. The Shah was a creature of the U.S. Intelligence services and the Mossad. And had a very established an extremely brutal regime. The struggle against the Shah lasted for a very long time, and the revolution that overthrew the Shah, hijacked though it may have been by the mullahs, nonetheless was immediately targeted for removal by the United States. And one point here, because I want to jump to the testimony we've just begun to mention about Brzezinski before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. When the revolution and the mass movement unfolded against the Shah of Iran, Jimmy Carter was the president of the United States, and his national security advisor was Zbigniew Brzezinski. The head of NATO, General Heuser, set up a headquarters in the top floor of the Tehran Hilton Hotel. They took the whole floor for something like 6 months, seeking to effect an army putsch or takeover to enlist some generals with nationalist credentials that would be able to provide a cover for an all-out massacre and suppression of the population, because they could see that the Shah was not going to be able to make it, that the movement had gone beyond the point where it could be contained. And when the revolution did, in fact, overthrow the Shah, one of the first things that happened was that the national security advisor to Carter, as president, Brzezinski, met with Saddam Hussein, then president of Iraq. The emir
mention, Ralph, excuse me, the duly elected president of Iraq.
Yes, I know. I mean, Saddam Hussein has his own history with the CIA and was, in fact, the U.S. instrument in Iraq for 27 years.
We hatched him, too.
Yes, but as you say, he was elected president of Iraq, and one thing that the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein did insist upon was the national unity of the country.
Mm-hmm.
That was this was a national movement. It was a national regime, and they were targeted by the United States and particularly the Israelis. Iraq was, as with Iran, to dismantle this country into ethnic and religious components. That policy design underlies what we see unfolding here. But to cut to the quick here, after the revolution in Iran in 1978, that overthrew the Shah of Iran, when Brzezinski met Saddam Hussein, along with the Emir of Kuwait and the King of Saudi Arabia, King Fahd, in Kuwait, they proposed that Iraq invade Iran and amputate the oil-producing province of Khuzestan in order to essentially emasculate the revolutionary government by taking away its oil base and its oil revenue. And the war that was unleashed, in which Iraq invaded Iran, was financed by all of the emirates and these feudal regimes in the Gulf that were under U.S. control. And the U.S. provided all the arms. And the people like Dick Cheney, who was the defense secretary, and Rumsfeld, who was the undersecretary of defense, were the vehicles for supplying Saddam Hussein with chemical and biological weapons and for providing military direction for the invasion of Iran. And when the Iranian population resisted, and when, in fact, that invasion was proving not successful, what Kissinger then recommended is that we bleed them both white. So they had the Israelis clandestinely providing some arms for Khomeini, ironically enough, while the Emirates and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the United States were flying Iraq with funds and with arms, and over 1 million people were slaughtered in that terrible war that Brzezinski and Carter had initiated. True. That's the background to the testimony we'll discuss in a moment.
Very good, and we'll be right back with Ralph Schoenman right after this. Ralph, of course, with Maya, has, they have made quite a name for themselves over the years with their marvelous radio program called Taking Aim. But urge you to click on Ralph's name up at the top of my homepage, Rents.com, and take a look and take a listen to Ralph and Maya. They are amazing. We'll be right back. Taking Aim, and we're taking aim tonight at the situation in the greater Middle East with Ralph Schoenman. All right, Ralph, before you jump into your narrative, let me just bring our listeners up to date on the Brzezinski bombshell, because it was pretty amazing. I want to read a couple quick paragraphs here to give everyone a background as to why this was so unusual, and I think it'll amplify what you're about to say. Testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Thursday, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor in the Carter administration, delivered a scathing critique of the Bush-Cheney war in Iraq and warned that the Bush administration's policy was leading inevitably to a war with Iran with incalculable consequences for U.S. imperialism in the Middle East and internationally. Brzezinski, who opposed the March 2003 invasion of Iraq and has publicly denounced the war as a colossal foreign policy blunder, began his remarks on what he called the war of choice in Iraq by characterizing it as a historic, strategic, and moral calamity. Undertaken under false assumptions, he continued, it is undermining America's global legitimacy, its collateral civilian casualties, as well as some abuses, are tarnishing America's moral credentials, driven by Manichaean principles and imperial hubris. It is intensifying regional instability. And a couple more sentences here. Brzezinski derided Bush's talk of a decisive ideological struggle against radical Islam as simplistic and demagogic, and called it a mythical historical narrative employed to justify a protracted and potentially expanding war. Further, quote, he said, to argue that America is already at war in the region with a wider Islamic threat of which Iran is the epicenter is to promote a self-fulfilling prophecy, he said, end quote. And most stunning and disturbing was his description, now get this one, of a, quote, plausible scenario for a military collision with Iran. It would, he suggested, involve Iraqi failure to meet benchmarks, followed by accusations of Iranian responsibility for the failure itself, then by some provocation in Iraq or a terrorist attack in the U.S. blamed on Iran. False flag. Culminating in a, quote, defensive U.S. military action against Iran that plunges a lonely America into a spreading and deepening quagmire, eventually ranging across Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, end quote, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yes, this is an extraordinary statement because he's saying to the Congress of the United States that the entire rationale for the war in Iraq is fictitious. The entire claim of some Islamic threat to the United States or some war of terror against the United States is a fabrication. And he actually states that the plans for a war in Iran will require a staged terrorist act, including in the United States, that will be blamed falsely on Iran in order to create a defensive rationale or a casus belli. I mean, it is unprecedented that a member of the ruling class goes before Congress to state that the United States is manufacturing provocations, including terrorist attacks within the United States. And he doesn't just leave it with a vague warning. He cited a March 27, 2006 report in the New York Times on, quote, a private meeting between the President and Prime Minister Blair 2 months before the war, that is to say the war launched against Iraq, based on a memorandum prepared by the British official present at the meeting. Brzezinski stated, quote, the President is cited as saying he's concerned that there may not be weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq, and consideration must be given to finding a different basis for undertaking the action. And then Brzezinski continues. He says, I'll just read you what this memo allegedly says. The memo states that the President and Prime Minister acknowledge that no unconventional weapons have been found in Iraq, and Mr. Bush talks about several ways to provoke a confrontation. He described the several ways in which this could be done. The ways were quite sensational, at least one of them. Now, what he's basically alluding to here is a sensational attack that will be blamed on Iran as it had been planned and to be blamed on Iraq.
And when he uses sensational, we think back, of course, to September 11th, and this is obviously going to have to be at least on the magnitude of one or two times that to get people's attention.
That's what he's talking about. And he said, if one is of the view, this is again Brzezinski speaking, that one is dealing with an implacable enemy that has to be removed, that course of action may, under certain circumstances, be appealing. I am afraid that if this situation in Iraq continues to deteriorate, and if Iran is perceived as involved or responsible, that temptation could arise. Now, what he's saying here is that they were prepared to undertake a sensational act to provide a pretext for the war in Iraq. He stated that they've already made clear that they will stage an operation, including acts in the United States. And then he goes on to say that this isn't going to be extremely tempting for the administration in order to get this war going in Iran. Now, none of the senators addressed themselves to the warning. None of the congressmen took up the testimony.
Nope.
When the testimony of the people who had appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was reported in the mainstream press, they reported on everybody except Brzezinski.
Isn't that amazing? Stop right there, Ralph. Just a lot to digest. So we're talking about a pretty dramatic, sensational event, folks, potentially. Maybe thousands dead, many more thousands in 9/11. Maybe a dirty bomb? Who knows? We'll be right back. Okay, right back with you. Extraordinary analysis. of the entire Middle East scenario with Ralph Schoenemann tonight. Okay, Ralph, let's go.
Well, you know, let me just mention, Jeff, that you and I have been citing a report by Barry Gray from the World Socialist website,
yeah.
Which is a daily newsletter, if you like, and I don't always have the same political perspective, although I largely share it, but they do a very excellent, competent, and professional newsletter, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for, particularly in regard to this story,
thanks
the
for
way they
it. Yeah,
elicited it, focused on it, and smoked it out.
Yep.
This is a really excellent piece of reporting on Barry Gray's part, and he actually confronted Brzezinski afterwards and asked him point blank, who do you think will be carrying out this provocation? Brzezinski at first was a little bit evasive, but then he said, I'm saying the whole situation can get out of hand and all kinds of all sorts of calculations will produce circumstances that will be very difficult to trace. Brzezinski is really laying this out, and he said something else. Jeff,
probably, excuse me, Ralph, real quick, probably more difficult to trace than 9/11. I think you're right. I think they're going to be more careful this time.
Yeah, and Brzezinski, I mean, rarely, I mean, he's virtually saying 9/11 is an inside job.
You sure?
In the body of his remarks, and he gives the specific memorandum in which Bush and Blair calculate how to take us and make a sensational stage, a sensational action to provide a justification or rationale or pretext for this war, but the war on Iraq now. But Brzezinski says another thing here that I want to cite. He says major strategic decisions are made within a very narrow circle of individuals, just a few. A handful, perhaps not more than the fingers on my hand. These are the individuals who made the original decision to go to war and used the original justifications to go to war, unquote. Well, what Brzezinski is describing with respect to the Bush administration and this particular war is, in fact, not peculiar to this administration. All these major decisions about major wars and attacks are made within a very narrow circle of people, and the actual point men are perhaps to be counted on one hand. The entire controlling ruling class is calculated to be, by Robert Townsend, to be approximately 5,000 people in number.
That's it.
The number of people who actually have the command over the heights of the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about is a cabal or a ruling class as a matter of sociological record. Power is enormously concentrated in capitalist America. And the entire political facade that we are treated to as a sort of scarecrow decoration is but the camouflage of this concentration of power, and they are in need of war. They are addicted to war. The origins of our present crisis are rooted in the decline of late capitalism and its total dependence on the military machine. Virtually since the Great Depression, I know that there's a great deal of illusion still in the United States about the role of the Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in supposedly bringing the United States out of depression. The fact of the matter is that in the middle of the second term of Franklin Roosevelt in 37 and 38, there was another depression, and it was even greater depth even than that of 1929. Something like 17 million people were thrown immediately out of work, and the scale of the economic collapse was staggering. The New Deal had no answer for this.
None whatsoever.
Aside. What they did was to transfer employment to the military apparatus. Within a space of something like 18 months, the percentages of unemployed were now engaged in working for the merchants of death.
Mm-hmm.
And U.S. capitalism, through this pump priming, has been dependent on military outlay in ever-increasing doses ever since, until the entire bureaucratic apparatus of the capitalist ruling class is wedded to and dependent upon this war machine. And the skirmishes between sectors of the class, when Eisenhower talks about a military-industrial complex, this is the same Eisenhower who authorized the putsch against Iran, the same Eisenhower who authorized the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala, the same Eisenhower who authorized the assassination of Patrice Lumumba.
Right.
In the Congo, when Lumumba led a party seeking national independence for the Congo, what was the Eisenhower advocacy on behalf, basically, of finance Eastern capital stating? We need counter-revolution on the cheap. We need killer squads and assassination units and Green Berets and Phoenix programs. That was essentially the same mantra of the Kennedy brothers. The Kennedys were opposed to a major ground war in Indochina that would involve hundreds of thousands of troops. It's deficit financing, it bankrupts, it undermines the stability of the dollar, it sets in motion vast forces, and the rationale of the Kennedy brothers, like Eisenhower, against this was out of the same playbook that Colonel James Gavin had put forward for the Kennedy brothers. The Kennedy brothers were fascinated with James Bond and with Green Berets and with killer squads. Uh-huh. That's the irony of all of this. Uh-huh. And what Brzezinski to come forward with this, and Brent Scowcroft and Bush Sr. and James Baker, uh-huh, who are critical of the current neocon, if you like, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush Jr. policy, mm-hmm, of preemptive and permanent U.S. occupation. What they are critical of is not the adventure, not the crushing of these countries, but the use of massive American troops to do so. This is the Brzezinski, mm-hmm, who staged the provocations in Afghanistan, who is the instrument for creating what became Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. This is the Brzezinski who instigated the Islamic fundamentalist terror units in Afghanistan and in the Central Asian republics of the Soviet Union, as he lays out in explicit detail in the great chessboard, grand chessboard. Mm-hmm. And what they are saying now is, when we did this in Afghanistan, and when we did our Gulf War, we devastated Iraq, all right, but we didn't occupy that country in a permanent occupation. We wanted to have our stooges do the dirty work for us. We armed them and supplied them. They wanted perhaps to take out Saddam like they took out Noriega after he'd serviced them for decades and replace, mm-hmm, him with another of, mm-hmm, like kind. Mm-hmm. But that's the nature of this dispute at the or difference within the class.
Yeah.
And the alarm that Brzezinski is expressing has to do with the fact that this has blown up in their faces in Iraq. Had they succeeded in crushing the Iraqi people, had this occupation, brutal as it was, been able to dismantle all social forms of resistance in
Iraq,
seconds, they'd be singing
seconds,
a very different tune today.
They certainly would. I concur 110%. Ralph Shonman is my guest. We'll pause and come right back with more. Back with Ralph Shumman. You know, one thing, Ralph, which has always amazed me is how Dwight David Eisenhower has come through history as some kind of a sanguine, quasi-grandfatherly figure. The man had blood dripping from his shoulders down. I mean, his role in so many things. I mean, let's go back to post-World War II Germany. The genocide, the extermination of over 1 million German POWs after the war ended. Overseen,
yes,
of course, by Ike, Churchill, and to a lesser degree, De Gaulle. The expulsion of the Cossack army by Eisenhower, which resulted in the deaths of probably a couple of million, we'll never know. The deaths of between 6 and 10 million German civilians in the years immediately after World War II. led, of course, by the West. We could talk about the war itself and the genocide of the German people, which was the aim of the war. Even Churchill admitted in his memoirs that the war in Europe in World War II had nothing to do with a war against Adolf Hitler or National Socialism. He said, in fact, it wouldn't matter to him if the Pope had been the head of the National Socialist Party. It was a war against Germany and its people. And that was what that was about. So Eisenhower was anything but our grandfatherly president of the 1950s.
Well, yes, let me address that. Churchill actually had been the preparer and advocate of something called Operation Vegetarian, which was the storing of vast amounts of anthrax cakes, which Churchill had laid out as a plan for disseminating anthrax throughout Germany, targeting the civilian population. Not only anthrax cakes, but also a campaign for poison gas. And Churchill admonished any within the military who took exception to these plans, which he called them silly sentimentalists and so on. No, the attitude of people like myself, revolutionary socialists, if you like, to World War II was no different than it was to World War I in this sense. It was a fight between imperial powers over the spoils, over colonial domain. It had absolutely nothing to do with the desire to defeat fascism, because fascism in Germany, National Socialism, was financed by all of the banking firms of the United States and Britain. The Dulles brothers, Alan and John Foster Dulles, were deeply involved up to their eyeballs. And within minutes of the end of World War II and even before, the SS and the SA and the German Wehrmacht General Staff were incorporated within the American military and within the U.S. intelligence services. Galen, the head of the East German apparat of Hitler, was put in charge of intelligence for the United States in the region. The heads of NATO were Heusinger and Speidel, who had been the general command of the Wehrmacht. So that this was an inter-imperial conflict. The struggle against fascism and repression of the population could only be waged by the populations themselves, or working people themselves, in their own interest. Their respective rulers were fighting over colonial territory, colonial domain, and hegemony over whole parts of the world. On this score, Jeff,
if I can, hold your thought,
please.
Right there. Hold your thought. You'd like to hold that thought. On that matter, it has just come to light, although I think you and I and many others suspected it, but there is now documentation without question that Uncle Joe, our ally, and I use that in quotes, was within weeks of a massive Soviet invasion of Eastern Europe in which Stalin expected to roll all the way to the English Channel in a matter of months, 8 or 9 months. So Hitler literally beat him to the punch and cut through enormous amounts of men and materiel who were not ready and not poised for a defensive war. They were getting ready for an offensive thrust into Europe. We know this now. We also know from a Finnish diplomat that an agreement apparently was reached between Churchill and Stalin in 1938 in which Hitler was to be forced into a two-front war, which would guarantee his eventual and Germany's eventual annihilation and subjugation.
Well, actually, you know, Jeff, the policy of Stalin after all, there was not the Hitler-Stalin pact, but Stalin was a very conservative bureaucratic dictator. Who the last thing that was on his mind was the expansion of revolutionary governments or movements in other parts of the world, because the workers' movement, when it sought power, did not seek to put it in the hands of a handful of bureaucrats and dictators like Joseph Stalin. Stalin was mortally afraid of the spread of revolutionary movements in other countries. As to his attitude towards Eastern Europe, Jeff, I have to say that Stalin had actually advocated the restoration of King Peter in Yugoslavia. Stalin was seeking to make sphere of influence deals with Churchill and Roosevelt. Stalin was only interested in stabilizing his own dictatorial rule in the Soviet Union.
How would you evaluate his performance in the 1930s in Ukraine, for example, Ralph?
The national question
correct.
Was the question on which Lenin and Trotsky broke with Stalin. Lenin called the empire of the Tsar the prison house of nations, but he stated, but the position of the Bolsheviks after the Bolshevik Revolution was that the each of the nationalities in the former Russian Empire had to make their own choice as to whether they would affiliate with the Soviet Union or not. This was not to be imposed. It had to emerge. This was a question for the workers and the population of each country to decide.
Quite a split between that and Stalin.
In fact, Trotsky and Lenin broke with Stalin not over the national question, and Lenin actually pleaded with Trotsky to form an alliance with him against Stalin. Lenin, in his last testament, ordered that Stalin to be removed from the Political Bureau. This is a long story, but there's much evidence that Lenin was actually poisoned by Stalin.
Right.
Isaac Don Levine, who was a former Menshevik and later became a quite conservative figure who was even associated with the Central Intelligence Agency, but I knew Isaac Don Levine, and he had documented quite amply that, in fact, Stalin had
been poisoned
Lenin. But ironically enough, he also documented that Stalin had been a long-standing agent of the Okhrana, the Tsar's secret police. Yes, during the very period that's before the Bolshevik Revolution.
Almost humorous, isn't it? All right,
yeah.
Well, let's get back to the topic at hand tonight.
Jeff, I wanted to mention one thing here, if I may.
Sure.
Because I think it will help illuminate this question of Brzezinski and Scowcroft and Bush Sr. challenging the neocons and this current Bush plan to attack Iran and to expand this war on a scale that we haven't yet seen. In 1984, I did a piece called Mondale Ferraro and Their Fine Feathered Friends. That had to do with the then election electoral contest between Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale. Walter Mondale was a liberal Democrat, the protege of Hubert Humphrey, considered to be part of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. In fact, the chief counselors on foreign policy to Walter Mondale were James Schlesinger and Max Kampelman, and they each accompanied Walter Mondale to briefings by the director of the National Security Council. James Schlesinger was one of the directors of the investment house of Shearson Lehman American Express. And his views on the deficit were identical to those of Ronald Reagan because he directed Ronald Reagan's campaign in 1976. James Schlesinger was director of the strategic studies at the Rand Corporation. He was senior staff member advising John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson from 1963 to 69. He directed the Bureau of the Budget for Richard Nixon and was Nixon's co-director of the Office of Management and Budget in 1971. Schlesinger served Richard Nixon as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission from 71 to 73. When Nixon resigned, Schlesinger carried on. He became Gerald Ford's director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 73 and his Secretary of Defense from 73 to 75. But James Schlesinger was a flexible man. He ran Ronald Reagan's challenge to General Gerald Ford's nomination in 76. When Ford lost to Jimmy Carter, James Schlesinger became the special assistant to President Carter, and Carter appointed him Secretary of the Department of Energy. That while Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, Schlesinger was, quote, more hawkish than his boss, unquote, advocated first strike capability, as he wrote position papers for when he was senior staff at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Max Campbellman is even more interesting. Campbellman's relationship to Walter Mondale long antedates that of James Schlesinger. He counseled Mondale, and Mondale was a protege of Hubert Humphrey, and Campbellman served under counsel for Hubert Humphrey from 49 to 55. Max Campbellman was Lyndon Johnson's advisor to the U.S. mission to the U.N. and was involved in orchestrating the air bombardment of Indochina. He served in the right-wing Atlantic Council of the United States from 65 to 70, and he was founder of the Neoconservative Committee on the Present Danger. The committee grew into the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, of which Campbellman was vice chairman. Campbellman established the Committee on the Present Danger. Now, the Committee on the Present Danger is the group that spawned this entire neocon agenda. Policies for the new American century.
Got it.
I could go on about this.
Oh yeah, we just got a few seconds.
Bridge all sectors of the class.
So Schlesinger and Campbellman, Schlesinger pipe in hand, were the grandfathers of the neocon movement as we now know it, basically PNAC. Fascinating.
And
hold on, Ralph. We'll come back and finish that off and move right on with our conversation tonight with Ralph Schoenemann.